Welcome to episode 68 of the Camerosity Podcast, the world's number one open source film photography podcast. My name is Mike Ekman, and today is the first day of April. It's been a busy news day today in the photography industry. Hey Theo, what's this I hear about Nikon buying Minolta and reviving that brand? What kind of Minolta cameras do you think Nikon will start making again?
Well, I think it's exciting on two fronts. One is they'll start making the Maxims and the Dynexes and all those kind of cameras again, which is great from Minolta's point of view. But they also get Konica, which means they start to make photocopiers, just like Canon.
Paul, don't you have any trips planned soon? If so, you might want to try out the Trolleyflex, a new design in luggage shaped like a Rolleiflex.
Well, you know, I looked at it. The problem is it's too big. So I'm waiting for the baby Trolleyflex. That'll fit in the overhead.
And Anthony, didn't you say you wanted to try a Leica M11? Maybe the new Leica M11H, the hybrid digital camera with a Huawei smartphone in the back. It just might be a bit more affordable. What do you think?
You know, I'd kind of sworn off all Leicas, but this one really has me intrigued. Because, you know, I could dump my iPhone and just travel with my Leica all the time. I think that would be, you know, the best camera is the camera that you have on you. So that would be killing a couple of birds with one stone.
That's true. Well, enough of news. We have a bunch of people in the waiting room. Let's let them in.
Good evening.
Ooh, I hear a familiar voice.
How y'all doing?
Is that Dan?
That's Dan Tamarkin, live and in person.
Hi, guys.
Welcome back.
The gang, thank you. The gang's all here.
You know, I looked at the last episodes you were on. You were on episode 22. You were on episode 44. So we should have had you back on 66, but
we're
a little late. Every 22nd episode, Dan Tamarkin appears on the Rusty podcast, but not this time. We have Bob Rodoloni. Bob's back. Long time no see.
Yep, I'm here.
All right. Mark Faulkner is back. Hey, Mark. Patrick Casey. Welcome back, Patrick.
Hello.
Ray Nason again. Hey. Alan Perez, the famous Alan Perez.
I'm here to defend myself.
Okay. He's real. I can see him. And I also see my friend Johnny Martyr. Johnny, welcome show.
Hey, guys. Nice to join you.
Awesome. I've met Johnny before. I flew out in 2001. Johnny lives in Frederick, Maryland, and I went out there to visit Mark and Adam Paul. And while I was there, I tried to check off as many people from my camera travels wish list that I wanted to meet with. And I met Ira Cohen on that trip, and I ended up meeting Johnny. We went out to a little bar, a little brewery, and had a couple brews, and we gave away a camera to, what was it, the bartender's daughter or something?
Yeah, that was really cool. I guess, were you with Mark, I guess, going a little camera shopping at the local antique shops? He picked up a few cameras, and I don't know how we ran into this girl, but it was really generous. Mark gave her a camera he just bought and showed her basically how to use it.
It was like a Mamiya, wasn't it? Like a MSX or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, Mamiya cool. SLR, I think. Yeah.
All right. Well, Johnny, you know, I'd mentioned coming on the show for quite a while, and you know, you're just super busy, but you know, it's great to see you finally here. While I think most people do know who you are, why don't you maybe, for anybody who doesn't, introduce yourself and just kind of, you know, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I guess maybe part of the reason too why I haven't hung out with you guys before is just because I'm totally self-conscious. Terrible at introductions and stuff. Yeah, 35 millimeter black and white photography in Frederick, Maryland, as you mentioned. I mean, I shoot a lot of weddings, family portraits, and I try to do political events, concerts, you know, sort of that type of thing too. I work with my wife. She shoots digital and she's a Nikon girl, and I'm famous around these parts as being a Leica guy, but I do shoot my Nikons too, and we can swap our lenses back and forth, and that's quite nice.
Which Leicas do you primarily shoot?
I am on a two M6 TTLs and Barnax. You hear me probably talk about it way too much, but my 1930 1:3 conversion is probably one of my favorite cameras. I carry it almost every day.
Now, lights famously would upgrade cameras back then. They'd add rangefinders. They'd swap out flash synchronization if necessary. Do you know the era in which your one was converted to a 3? Or was that a recent conversion or something from way back then?
Yeah, no. I purchased it a few years back. I was picking up a repair order for my usual tech in Baltimore, who's unfortunately is place is recently closed, and I was picking up some equipment from him, and he happened to have it. I didn't realize how old it was, because I just honestly I had like a 3F, and then I had a 3C, and you know, I had these sort of recent models, so I didn't know too much about these earlier ones when I purchased it. Following down the serial number with a buddy of mine who's more knowledgeable of these things, turned out that it was a 1930, and it had been converted probably around 1935, 36. Like it was originally a 1C, and it was converted to a 3. When I wrote to Leica about the serial number information, told me that the only thing that they had on it was the date that it left the factory, which was in 1936. They didn't have like anything prior to that, so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
One sort of quirk about it that I thought people seem to maybe are interested in, it has a little cutaway on the film gate, and sort of, you know, you can always tell which camera a frame came out of because it's got this little sort of fingerprint.
Hi, Johnny. It's Theo here. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Theo.
In person for it.
Yeah.
Is there any particular reason why you've sort of moved towards the old Leicas? Because I know you do a lot of low light photography with weddings and so on. So is that something that sort of helps with that kind of photography, or is that just something you like to use?
I use the M6TTLs for sure for low light stuff. I don't use Barnex for low light very much because the viewfinders are pretty dim. I guess what happened is that I started, the first Leica I purchased was a 3F, and I wasn't really that into the sort of the flash clutter, as I call it, on those cameras, because I don't use flash, so I just didn't like the distraction of it. So I moved to the 3C, which was really clean. But I was shooting on Nikon SLRs for most of my paid work up until that point. And then I was just amazed when I picked up the Barnack Leicas and was like, wow, these are really, in terms of usability, like they feel a lot like a modern camera. And as you guys know, they're kind of the basis for the layout of modern cameras. So I guess that I just kind of fell in love with that. So I just like the smallness and portability, particularly the 1930. It just has like a way that it feels. So I use those more for more brightly lit situations than the low light stuff, if that answers your question. But the M6TTL, that's an amazing low light camera. I love that.
Johnny, do you use the meter built into the camera?
Yeah, I do. Sometimes I get slack from veteran photographers for that. But I like to emphasize, especially for paid work, I think it's important to be accurate. But also just, you know, even for my stream of conscious daily kind of stuff, I like to consult the meter. But I guess what I like to emphasize about that and focusing is I think it's important to be able to walk into a scene and guess what your focus and your exposure should be by eye, and then to have an instrument to verify that, as opposed to the other way around, which I think is maybe what we tend to do when we're beginning. We lean on the camera. I like to do it myself and then verify with the camera, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that's the I bought an M6 at the Leica school in 1986.
Oh, cool.
And I still use it with a black Wetzlar.
Oh, that's great.
To me, it's, you know, everybody likes their own camera, but to me, the M6 was the ultimate in the Leica rangefinder system. I mean, it was just I and oddly enough, the one I dislike the most is the M3. I just don't like the M3. I don't like the viewfinder. I don't like the fact it doesn't have 35 millimeter frames. It just always bugged me. The M2 was fine, but the M6 has everything I need in a viewfinder.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you bring that up. I keep I haven't finished it yet, but I keep kind of working on a M3 roast article, roasting the M3, because there's a lot of things that's
gonna go over well.
I know. I like this turns out. The M3, you know, obviously is a historically significant and great camera, but I could not shoot weddings with an M3. I could not do what I do, like doing the work the way that I do it personally anyway, with an M3. The M6, specifically the M6TTL, is, I think, just the perfect camera for me. In fact, I think Mike, maybe like we met online, maybe in part because I had written an article that sort of angered a lot of people.
You had written the Konica 3 and you referenced my site a bunch of times, and I was like, who's this guy?
Oh.
And I contacted you, and then at that point I was already talking to Mark and Adam, and like, oh, we know him.
Okay.
And that And that was it. But I think I know where you're going. I probably screwed up your segue there.
But no, maybe I'm just thinking about the camera blogger community in general seemed to sort of catch wind of me when I wrote an article professing my love for the M6 TTL. It was sort of a hyperbole, meant to be humorous article, but a lot of people got really angry by it.
And I want to come back to a couple of things you said, but while we were talking, we had another person join. Brock, you want to introduce yourself real quick?
Sure, sure. Name is Brock, Northern Michigan, and just like cameras.
The one thing I want to touch back that you said, Johnny, when you were talking about how you couldn't use the M3 for what you do, you said for how I shoot, for how I do it. And I think that's a very, very valid point that a ton of people miss. Especially when they start to talk about liking one model over another, or maybe they don't like a model that's very popular, or maybe they do like, you know, something like that. I think that everybody has kind of their own way of doing things. I'm similar to you, and like what Paul said too, I don't shoot slide film because I don't want to rely on a meter. I prefer just guessing. To me, that's part of the fun. You know, I don't shoot professionally like you do. I don't shoot even as much as Anthony does. You know, I have a blog and I'm on a podcast and I probably shoot less film than half the people on this show. But it's because I do things a certain way and you do too. And I think that that's really valid. And a lot of things people will miss. Like, well, what do you mean you don't like the M3? Or what do you mean you don't have a handheld meter? Or what do you mean you don't shoot this way or that way or something like that? And that's all fine and dandy for how they do it. But like the way you do it is a certain way and it works for you. And I think that's really valid in what should be taken into consideration when people talk about one model over another.
Yeah, Mike, I completely agree with that. And that's actually, I'm glad you elaborated on that because I was kind of hinting at that. I love talking cameras. I love comparing one model to the other. And as much as you guys probably do, well, I know you do, and I enjoy that too. I'm not as much of a collector as you guys, but I read all your posts and listen to the podcast, and I love the back and forth and comparing things. But I think that a lot of disagreement can come out of this sort of how we base the comparisons. I'm working on an article about clip-on light meters right now, the little accessory issue light meters that are popular right now. I think there's a lot of them out there, just like cameras, and people, you know, compare them based on specs. But what a lot of comparisons aren't made for or made by is how we use this stuff and what our intentions are and our purposes. Like if you want to not use a meter and shoot a few shots a day, Sunny 16, do things a little slower, more deliberate, like that's just a different style. And so you're going to maybe want like different cameras, different tools for that purpose. So
switching over to Dan, Mr. Dan, have you ever heard of this Johnny Martyr guy? Is he someone you're familiar with?
I sure have heard of him. I've never met him, but we've talked. I think we talked on the phone. We've definitely talked over email.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And I also subscribed to his. I subscribed to his newsletter. I subscribed to his blog, which is terrific. And I would encourage y'all to subscribe to. I don't happen to know exactly the address.
Yeah, it's Johnny Martyr at WordPress.com. But yeah, thanks for your continued support, Dan. I appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. The articles are terrific. And I think you have a great sense of humor. You know, back to that first M6 TTL article you wrote, just for the record, I want to say that I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, that's really good. That makes me glad. I got so many like hate messages after that.
Oh, I know. I know people can be very opinionated. And I think that both you and Mike just touched on, you know, a very important thing in photography. And I think in other aspects of life as well, which is there's not really a right or a wrong. It's what's right for you. Mm-hmm. Or what's wrong for you? I happen not to like the M3 myself. I mean, the viewfinder of the M3. Mm-hmm. I'm an M2 guy.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, Johnny, it's interesting because you use the TTL, though you don't use flash. And the reason I have an M6 because I have an M6, but I'd rather have a TTL only because it has three diodes rather than two.
Yeah, yeah.
On an M3, on an M6, and you see one diode, you don't know if you're a half stop off or five f-stops off from correct. On the M6 TTL, you've got three diodes, so you've got you know when you're getting close to being right. If you want to over or under expose a half a stop, it's very easy to do.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Back to Dan's comment on the M3 and the M2. also. I think it was like the M2 really solidified, I think, the viewfinders to come. So I think that makes a lot of sense. But it has the sort of that old school, like a hand-built, what is it, a just-in-fit build quality that the M3 is also known for. So I can appreciate the love for the M2 there. As far as the M6 versus the M6 TTL, yeah, I don't use Flash. A lot of people, I think, maybe because of the namesake with the M6 TTL, people associate it with Flash. I think I've probably never even put flashes on either one of them, so I'm not even sure if they work. I don't know. Like I said, I was a Nikon guy. I was shooting. I always wanted to be a rangefinder guy, and I had little cheapies here and there, but I don't know, just sort of fell into the Nikon ecosystem and was doing that mostly at first. But they have the three LEDs too. The FM series has the FM series, and the late F2 series have the three LED diodes that you mentioned. And so I guess when I was selecting a Leica, that was important to me, was to sort of remain consistent with what I was used to. One of the things I talk a lot about is the importance of muscle memory. And part of the reason I love Leica so much is because they're just so consistent across history with their features and layouts. I think muscle memory is like super important to just reacting fast for the type of work that I do. But it's funny that I bring up consistency, because the M6 TTL, the thing that sort of throws people on it is the shutter speed rotates the opposite direction. It's in line with their digital series of cameras. So if you shoot like a digital, you're probably more happy with M6 TTL or M7 analog, whereas all the other Leicas, the shutter speed dial rotates the opposite way. So that throws.
Johnny, you mentioned the Nikons that you use and the FM2. Is there a particular reason why you're picking that camera as well? I mean, similar question to what I asked earlier, but about the Leicas, but is there a particular reason you're picking that camera over, say, an F2 or F3?
Yeah. I'm pretty notorious for hating the F3. I'm gonna widen that. You can't see the meter readout in low light in that camera. Like so many people, when they shoot the F3 in low light, they rely on auto exposure to get the shot, and I don't want to have to lean on that. So I'm an F2 guy. I had the F3 first, and I punted back to the F2SB specifically because I like to use pre-AI lenses, and I like that 3 meter or 3 diode LCD. Metering, like we talked about. I like to use the FM2N specifically. My first Nikon was an FM, so I like that form factor, and the FM2N was just the perfect combination of a brighter view screen, higher shutter speeds, just great low light capability. So and I guess I got into Nikon because I actually started on Pentax, and Pentax, I love the quality of the came out lenses, and I just fell in love with vintage cameras through Pentax. But I didn't find, once I started doing paid work, I just didn't find the whole stop down metering thing being fast enough for me to use, and like dimmer viewfinders and smaller lens selection. So I picked up an FM sort of by chance, and it was a Nikon guy after that.
Yeah, you haven't been tempted on getting up to the FM3A?
I just don't have a use for it because I don't shoot with any automation. I keep looking at the FM3A because I like new cameras. I like old cameras. Like I love my 1930 Leica. When I'm like shooting a wedding for 12 hours, I don't want to rely on something that's 100 years old all the time. So I do like and I also like to support newer equipment. Like I like the idea of being able, like, one of the reasons I love Leica is, not that I can afford to, but I could walk into Dan's right now and buy a brand new one, right? And it would be just like what, I was shooting with 20 years. So I love that concept.
About the FM2, in my opinion, I've looked at the FM3A also, and I've been on the fence. Hong Lee had one at one of the Chicago shows, and I played with it. And it's a fantastic camera. It's great. However, it's quite a bit more in terms of money of a step up from the FM2. And just in my mind, it's not worth the significant jump in price for what you get, especially if AE isn't something you need. Take away the AE, the FM2 is not only is a less expensive camera, although the prices on that have gone up too. But that to me, that is like the sweet spot Nikon for me. I agree. The F3 is a great camera. I don't use mine too often. I love the F2s quite a bit. I think the F2 is a more usable camera over the original F, but it's big, it's heavy. The FM2 is just that right balance of the smaller body. It has everything I need. The titanium one to 4,000th top shutter speed, a great display. You can change the viewing screens. And it's got the LEDs like you talked about. So super reliable. And they made them up until, I think, Robert, when did they stop making the FM2? Like 2000, something like that? He's nodding yes, but he's on mute. But yeah, they made the FM2 for almost 20 years.
Yeah, Johnny, this is Anthony here.
Hey, Anthony.
I'm also a massive FM2 and fan. As a matter of fact, when I was a freshman in Indiana University in my first photography class, it was the winter of 1982. And I think I probably got one of the first FM2Ns sold by B&H.
Oh, nice.
And that camera has been with me ever since. I mean, I still shoot that camera quite a bit. I've shot more frames on that FM2 than any camera that I've owned. But the question I have for you is, it couldn't be more chalk and cheese with your Leica M6 TTL. So I'm wondering, do you if you still use the FM2, and does it like enter into your workflow for your wedding photography, or is it just more of a like a personal travel all around camera for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I know what you're saying. There's definitely some big differences. Obviously, just an SLR to rangefinder, but I think the feature set, you know, it's just the basic feature set and good ergonomics and a small body. One of the things I do with the my FM2 ends is, I have FM3A view screens in them. The brighter, I think they're K3, I think is the designation. So I'm just all about having that super bright viewfinder that I can see in low light. On the SLRs, you know, having like the faster lens is obviously important to brighten up the viewfinder too. But I just love Nikon for some of the same reasons I love Leica. I love that, you know, they continued making all manual cameras for as long as they did. Nikon, obviously, you know, they handed things over to Cosina for a bit and pulled out of the 35 millimeter SLR market. They were like one of the last holdouts. And I love that, you know, a few years ago, I don't remember how long ago it was, but if in recent times, I was able to purchase a brand new 55-28 micro Nikkor, which any wedding photographer, you know, you need a macro lens. So I was able to buy that brand new, you know, and I just think that's really cool to be able to buy brand new equipment that's styled after this like 1960s, 1970s kind of like ethos. I guess, yeah, I think, you know, for weddings, you're shooting every genre of photography, people like to say. You know, it's candids, it's posed, it's food, it's architecture, you know. And so, yeah, I definitely like to use both my SLRs and my rangefinders for like a longer, more elaborate day, like a 12-hour day where I'm shooting bride from the time that they sip their first, I say from the first sip of coffee to the last sip of champagne at the end of the night. You know, it's good to have both those systems, but sometimes I just pack it light, like on a smaller sheet, I'll choose one or the other based on various things. Sometimes, honestly, it's just, you know, how I'm feeling as if I'm going to shoot SLR or rangefinder.
I'm always interested about this increase in interest in film, you know, how it's making a comeback. You know, everybody's buying film, everybody's shooting film. But my question for you is like demand. You know, your wife shoots digital, you shoot film. Do you go along with her on every shot, or like what, how often are you guys together working on a wedding versus where it's only digital? Because I have to imagine some people just don't care. They just want pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great question. I get variations of this question pretty frequently. So it's interesting. Like when we first started working together, she had a little bit more interest in film. And so we were kind of like, I had been shooting before I met her. And so I had done the whole, like, I would show up. I remember one of my first bigger shoots, I was photographing Bill Clinton for Retirement Companies magazine. I shot on my FM and I shot on like a D, I don't know, whatever was out then, like a D90 or something ridiculous like that. So I was always shooting everything like hybrid, like I was shooting film and digital. And my goal was, and I was also working for a wedding studio at the time. So we were doing all the candids on digital and the formal stuff on like Hasselblads. So I had always been working in this hybrid environment, and I was like, why am I shooting on these cameras and this style that I don't really like have as much of an affinity for? I know, you know, obviously you have to make deadlines and that kind of thing, especially when you're doing like new stuff. So I just, my whole like thrust of things was to move towards film. So when I met my wife, she appreciated that, and she's really helped me, you know, continue to do that, right? But anyway, as far as demand goes, yeah, a lot of our clients don't give a damn if I'm shooting on film or not, but I guess they must like the photos. So that's like the main thing. Now, some people, they'll try to haggle us on price, and, you know, they think like, well, if we don't bring the digital, or if we didn't bring the film on, you know, save some money or something like that. We usually like to shoot together just because we enjoy that, but we do shoot separately sometimes too. And it's interesting, she gets all the, like, she's doing athletic photography right now lately too, so she gets that stuff and the family portraits solo, but I get the weddings solo. She doesn't really, people don't really hire her as much for digital wedding stuff, but they do hire me solo for film, which actually is what Mark did. So, you know, I think there is a market. There are people that have an appreciation for black and white and for film, and they want that aesthetic. In fact, I see a lot of wedding photographers now. It's kind of pissing me off, frankly. they're prominently digital folks, and they're offering film photography as part of their package, but they're only shooting like a couple of rolls. They're not really prepared. They come in with these, like, you know, Canon AE-1s that have never been serviced. They only have like one of them. They tell you like, well, we're only going to shoot 3 rolls of film, and, you know, it's not really a film-centric photographer, but it's kind of become...
It's a value-added option, right?
Exactly. See, I'm a terrible business person, but you know the term. But yeah, like, so to your point, like, film is becoming more popular, and it's people are aware, and it's in their minds, and so they are looking for it, so much so that these digital photographers are jumping on the bandwagon, right? So I think it's kind of funny, like, actually.
I've got a question about, I'm an old film shooter from way back, like everybody. Do clients, what in the mind of the average guy or woman who's not into photography, what do they perceive as the difference between film and digital? I mean, what do you find people expect when you shoot film? And when...
Yeah. No, that's always amusing too. When I started shooting over 20 years ago, for a long time I was shooting color. And especially when I teamed up with my wife, people couldn't really tell the difference between our shots. There were a lot of reasons why I moved to black and white, but one of them was just so that I could kind of distinguish myself a little bit more, not only from my wife's work, but also just from digital in general. Like, one of the things that's always been important to me, I shoot with a lot of high speed grainy film. I like to emphasize my grain in my shots. Like, I kind of want to let people know, hey, this is something different. This isn't what you're seeing, you know, in magazines and stuff, traditional realms. But anyway, my point is, yeah, some people don't know the difference or can't see the difference. You know, they just like good photos, and that's fine too. But I do get some strange reactions. You know, I still get people like trying to look at the back of my camera for, you know, chimping a shot. You know, it's always fun. Or people, you know, especially the people, like, if I showed up at a wedding, obviously the only people that I've interacted with are maybe the immediate family, but usually just the bride and groom in a lot of cases. So I show up there and I'm shooting film. I'm like working these cameras and, you know, by hand and everything. And, you know, I get some looks from like the people that haven't, you know, the people that used to shoot film, and they're like, hey, I haven't seen somebody doing that for a long time.
Doesn't that slow you down though? Do you get people wanting to talk like us though?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, it's funny because after the new M6 was announced, I actually, people before, I was like, people would be like, oh yeah, I used to have a Canon AE-1 in high school. I used to shoot, you know, and but now I was like, I get these people coming up to me and they're like, hey, is that a Leica M6? I'm like, yeah, it is actually. Like, so it's pretty cool, like, how people are becoming aware of film photography. Yeah. and Leica, and, you know, just it's cool. Like, it's I don't have to keep, for a while there it was touch and go. I felt like I had to explain myself, like, what is this guy doing?
So Dan, are you seeing that here in Chicago a lot too? People wanting their wedding shot on film and coming to you or local photographers and asking them if they do something like he does?
Not specifically, but we have seen a huge uptick in just shooting film and the sales of film cameras. I know that there's a lot of interest in it. I really don't do any kind of professional shooting, although I do hear some pros grousing about it, well, people wanting to talk cameras and kind of getting in their way, but also just about this new, quote, I'm using air quotes here, this new film thing that's happening. And I do think that Leica has done a terrific job in raising awareness of their brand, increasingly younger set of either photographers or aspiring photographers or people who in one way or another are aspiring to either photography or the brand. And, you know, I what I tell people at the sales counter is like, you know, they're nervous about carrying a Leica maybe. And I say, you know what? 85% of the people you're going to meet have no idea what that camera is. And they're going to look at you and they're going to say, look at that guy using an old, cheap, old, ratty camera, right? The other 15% are going to come up to you foaming at the mouth and ask you which model, what lens. And, you know, I'm one of those people, you know, the Leica fans, but most people don't really know what they are. But increasingly, we're seeing people recognize the brand and wanting to get into film, even though they began with digital to begin with.
And I'll tell you, I never shot a wedding commercially in my life, but as a person who's attended weddings, I would take my M3 with me, just take personal photos. And it's usually the other photographers, the professional photographers, that are freaked out that I'm there with a Leica.
Oh, yeah.
It makes them more nervous than, you know, the bride and groom would ever be seeing a film camera there.
Yeah, they're like, oh, who's this guy? Who's this guy? Yeah.
So Johnny, I'll just say that I wish that I'd met you 28 years ago, because when I got married, you know, as a photographer at the time, I was adamant in meeting with the photographer that he was going to shoot a significant amount of Tri-X at my wedding.
Oh, yeah. Tri-X is one of my go-tos.
Because I wanted the look. I wanted the grain. I wanted the shadow. And it wasn't until like a month after the wedding that I realized that he completely blew me off, acted like I didn't know what I was doing, shot the whole thing in Portra. And when I confronted him about it, he's like, I can just fix it in Photoshop. I'll just desaturate it if you really want black and white. And I was like, it's not the same.
It's not the same.
I'm still angry about that.
That's frustrating. Yeah. I hope that the weddings I shoot for other photographers, you know, they're happy with the results. I just, this and last year, I've got a few of those guys. And the last one I did, his wedding got rained out. It got moved inside. And so I think, you know, maybe his wife was expecting these big, bright photos, but I was at, you know, Tri-X at like 1600 and T-Max 3200 at 6400 and like this kind of stuff. And so they're much, much moodier. I think they're great photos, but I always wonder, you know, because you get feedback from people.
Johnny, if we could find somebody like a photographer who knows what you do and has had you shoot one of their weddings, maybe they could come on the show and tell us what they thought of the pictures.
Oh, that'd be neat.
Mark.
No, I mean, that was kind of the whole point, though, is that, I mean, having that sort of different look from the standard wedding shots. And also, as somebody that shoots quite a bit and loves the grain, I was all about that. And I was thrilled to see the results that we got back. And it was also just when I got to handle the camera briefly during the one portion of the was it the pre? We were having the
like cocktail hour, I guess.
Yeah.
I think I passed you an M6 at that point.
Yeah. So yeah, I fully knew that's what the look that I wanted to go for with the shots, and they came out better than I could have hoped.
Oh, that's great. Thanks.
It's style. I mean, it comes down to the style of what you are comfortable with, what the client wants, what you're comfortable in providing. And you know, you have a very unique style, and it's not a style that you can get by shooting digital and using Nick to convert to black and white. It just isn't the same. And it works for you. So that's the important part. And you know, your clients are your best advertisers, because they're going to be happy with the work and it's going to bring more work. It's different from a guy who, like you said, you work for a wedding studio. You know, that's different. That's assembly line type process.
Yeah, it sure was.
And everybody, the work, if it's a good studio, every shooter shoots the same way that the other shooters shoot. So it's consistent.
Yeah, that's probably why I don't work anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So your style is your own.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I wouldn't trade. I worked for like a wedding studio. We were shooting four or five weddings a weekend in, you know, the spring through fall. You know, it was just, it was exhausting. It was relentless. And it really kicked my ass. But I learned a ton from it. I still keep up with my old boss there, and I learned so much from him and from just working that business. But I was always on that mission to like do, you know, find my voice, and my voice is pretty narrow and pretty specific. But I like to think that the people that, you know, that I'm giving something to people that it's hard to find elsewhere. So I hope everybody that's looking for me finds me. That's that's all.
It's actually interesting you mentioned the studio production line. When I got married, and I'm coming up to 25 years now, and I had to try and organize my wedding in a different state and city. So it was a bit of an ordeal. But the photographer that we sort of met, he came in with his RB67, and which was the standard kit at the point, and an SLR. And of course, you know, I said to him up front, I said, yeah, I hope you've brought enough film, because I'm not going to, you know, I've got a few ideas of what I want photographed and that. I don't think he quite understood the context of it, because I was doing photography already, that, you know, I would actually have quite a few ideas that we needed to do. And we get towards the end and he's run out of film.
What?
this isn't good here. And he actually had to scramble to a 7-Eleven and get a whole bunch of, I think it was Superior or something like that. So a portion of my wedding was actually shot on 7-Eleven Superior stored film.
Nice.
You know, which God knows what that could have turned out with. But luckily it turned out all right. And and I suspect if I hadn't actually sat there and said, yeah, I want these kind of shots, it would have been the production line type stuff. And I would have actually been quite unhappy.
Well, in the US, Ray knows about this because he's been through it too. In the U.S., wedding photographers are the biggest copycats in the world. I mean, if you're a successful wedding photographer, you can start doing seminars for other wedding photographers to teach them what you do and make more money doing it than you can shooting weddings.
Yeah, and selling the presets and everything. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, it's not just that, but, you know, flash diffusers, brackets.
Gary Fong.
Yeah, Gary Fong type stuff.
Yeah, BlackRock.
I mean, it's crazy.
I think like Instagram and Etsy in some ways helps the types of wedding photographers that just want to shoot cookie cutter images, because there's like an unlimited catalog for young brides to look at what kinds of shots, you know, the ring picture, you know, weird, funny, smashing faces in cake pictures, you know, those typical shots you just got to check off the list. And I think that if your aim is to just make as much money as possible and just churn out a product, you just go on Instagram and show a bunch of the generic wedding pictures that probably 80% of brides are, that's what I want on my wedding too, right? I mean, I think that in order to truly differentiate yourself from just another generic photographer, it takes work. And I mean, that's kind of like what you're doing, Johnny. You wanted the grain, you wanted images that didn't look like your wife's, you know? I'm sure the first time you heard somebody tell you they couldn't differentiate your work from hers was probably very deflating to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, the first couple of years that we were working together, we definitely had some back and forth about, you know, because she was shooting digital and she'd convert things to black and white. And I was like, oh, you can't do that. Like, you know, and I'm shooting in color and people are like, oh, well, you know, which one of you took this one? You know, and we both had some identity struggles with that. I think ironed them out for the most part. But you know, I do want to say though, one of the things, you know, back to the studio I used to work for, Bradley Images in Baltimore, by the way, Brad Zizzo, he taught me a lot. And one of the things that always impressed me with this guy, I don't agree with it, but his philosophy was, I'm going to give people exactly what they want, no matter what they want. He had offered to shoot my wedding. I reluctantly had to decline. I had another guy, good friend of mine also, and shot his whole thing is I can do anything. Like, I can shoot it if you want me to shoot this on Leica or Hasselblad, or you want me to shoot this on, you know, digital, you want to make it warm, you want to make it cool, you want to whatever, you know, you want it photojournalism style, you want it like abstract, or you know, you name it. Like, this guy, he's a great chameleon, I guess. Now, I guess the thing that I got out of that when I was young is he's so talented and so technically very skilled, proficient photographer, but I felt like, you know, for me, I wanted a vision. I was still putting my vision together at that time, but that was important to me, is like having a signature. And I think survival of modern professional photographers in some ways relies on having that distinction. But there is a big business for people that, yeah, just all kind of do it the same way. But I get frustrated with that sort of style photography, and I feel like people should be exploring their own voices and that kind of thing. But it's tough. Like when you're trying to make a living at photography, not to do what the client wants, you know, like it's frustrating for me. The few times I've had clients and they didn't really understand what I did, they just hired us because they, you know, somebody knew somebody and the price was right, or you know, something like that, something basic like that, you know. And they got the photos and they didn't really understand what I was going for, you know, and it's kind of heartbreaking, you know, to have to deal with that sort of, you put your best into that and it's not reciprocated. It's not appreciated. So yeah, I mean, I can see both sides of it. I'm on my side, but I understand the other side.
So, I mean, we've talked a lot about your business. Does anybody else have any questions for Johnny? Alan?
Well, I'm here because in the last episode, I feel like I got caught in the crossfire between Gabe and Jeff from the I Dream of Cameras.
Who are they?
I'm not here to start it up again. But Paul said, how come you never write us? And I thought, well, I ought to just show up and for a few minutes and it's better than writing letters or writing emails.
Well, Alan, I follow you on Facebook and I enjoy your posts. So I'm glad you showed up. And
okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, and the thing with Rick and Morty and the gang at I Dream of Cameras, they're good sports and they're good people and they do a good podcast.
Oh, I know it was all in jest. Or I'm assuming it was all in jest.
It was all in jest, and it's been a lot of fun for everybody.
I was excited to hear that Johnny was going to be here. And although you didn't specifically say it, that Dan was going to be here, because sometime just before COVID struck, I have a Leica 3F that I inherited from my father-in-law. And the lens was fogging up. And so because I'm in the Chicago area, I brought it in to Dan. And he said, well, we can clean it up, or we'll try to clean it up, and we'll take a look at it and give it a CLA, which he did. And it's working well. I unfortunately don't use it enough, but because I think I'm a little afraid of taking the Leica out, as you were talking about earlier, Dan, you know, about people saying, oh, look at that camera. But I do need to get it out and exercise it and use it the same way I use my Olympus XA.
So Dan, if I can change directions for just a second, among the Camerosity podcast hosts, there's been this like pernicious virus that's moved through the other hosts, and it began with Theo and this like weird talk about, oh my God, is this a 2-cam lens or a 3-cam lens? And then, you know, Mike's like, oh, this R8, you know, what, you know, I'm not sure about this form factor. And then Paul moves in like a drug dealer and starts acquiring like massive lots of Leica SLR bodies. So I'm curious, as a person that is a preeminent Leica dealer, what's your take on the Leica SLR market? You know, what do you see as the trends? What are the ones that you like to sell? What do you recommend? You know, what's your overview?
I'd like to first say that I would like to think that I set some of that. I had some hand in setting all of this Leica-itis in motion.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to think that I played some small part in it. But, you know, it's funny. I was just having a conversation similar to this with about our cameras with a client, and we really don't handle the R series very much anymore. We handle the lenses because people like to use them on different cameras. They like to use them on the SL platform or other L mount cameras or Sony's or whatever, Fuji's, whatever people are putting lenses on these days. And I think that's great. The problem that we're having and that we've been facing for years is that fewer and fewer technicians work on the R series cameras. So even though the market is very strong for them, I think, I mean, people are shooting film like there's no tomorrow, you know, like I said, this quote unquote new film thing, this fad that's happening. So it's kind of a shame that a lot of these cameras have fallen by the wayside, mainly because there's no one repairing them. Now, there are people that I know that work on the Leica Flex and Leica Flex SL and SL2 models. And I think they're terrific. I mean, they're heavy. Mike's waving a Leica around right now. I see you there. So I think they're terrific. I mean, I learned the first Leica I ever shot was an R3. And if you've seen my photographs, that's really not saying very much at all. But so I'm familiar with them. And it's kind of a shame that there aren't technicians working on them, because I feel like the market would be a little bit stronger. I'll tell you that even with this new film fad that we're all experiencing, the last time we got a call about an R camera was months ago. People just don't call about that stuff much anymore. But then again, we also don't really have very much advertised on our website, because we really just don't take it in much anymore.
Yeah, they're all calling Paul.
Right.
Dan, I don't know if you saw, but I made an 800-mile round trip day to pick up a collection of SLRs. And there were like 7 bodies, and I think there were 10 or 12 lenses. Everything from 19 millimeter to a 400 f5. But the coolest two were a black paint SL Mott and a black chrome SL2 Mott.
Yeah, you don't see those every day.
No, those are scarce.
Those are rare. And so, and actually, Anthony, to your, you know, back to your question for a moment, I will say the collectible market's a little bit different, like the 50 RA or models like Paul's talking about, like, or the original Leica Flex in black paint, or anytime you have full sets. But Paul, I would just like to thank you for taking care of that collection, because I hate to say it, and I'm lucky to have to say it, but we turned down a lot of our stuff. There's not enough of a market for it. And believe me, I cannot stand to turn down any camera stuff, let alone Leica stuff. But the market is, as I see it, is just kind of, at least in my little corner, it's just kind of weak. And really the service is the biggest problem.
Yeah. Well, the big problem too is that the lenses got expensive because the Cine people started snapping up the lenses. They were paying top dollar for the lenses. Then they would send them and have them modified for Cine use. And so you've got bodies with no lenses to put on them.
That's what frustrates me so much, especially with the early Rs, like the R3 and the R4. I mean, what are you selling an R4 body for, Paul?
$150. If it's in serial number over 1,600,000. They'll go for $150.
So $150 for a Leica SLR that in every stretch of the way is a good camera, but because you don't have a lens for it, it's just not worth anything. And you go on eBay and search for any Leica SLR, even the SLs, and they are 95% body only, because the lenses are just disappearing into the cine market, like you said. So while it's great that people love those lenses and they're finding new homes, I think, in my opinion, Dan, that's it. In addition to lack of people being able to repair them, I think that the lenses disappearing from the SLRs is another reason people don't shoot the SLRs.
I think you're right, Mike. And I'll tell you, for any of your listeners, I've got boxes of R lenses. We just don't bring them to market because they're going to wind up on eBay. We don't bring them to market in our store because we can't sell them clean. And so we have a lot of that stuff. We sell it as is. But 50 Summicrons, Leica Flexes. I got a box of R3s. I mean, God bless. If you could sell them, it's great. We have a really hard time with that. But it's great gear.
A 3-cam 50 millimeter F2 Summicron is in good condition, is a $500 to $600 lens.
Agreed.
And people will buy them and put them on Sonys or Nikons or any mirrorless camera. It'll bolt right onto it.
Sure.
In fact, it'll bolt onto the Nikon DSLRs just with a Litex adapter. So it's easy to change the mounts.
And that's the way to go, if you ask me. I mean, I think optics make the image. You know, this is what I tell people at our sales counter all the time and over the phone and over email. You know, if you take a Leica lens and you put it on a shoebox and you get a Leica image. If you take a POS lens and you put it on a $100,000 Leica, you still get a POS image, you know, from an optical standpoint. So I think optics make the image. And if it were me and on any kind of budget, I would go for the lens first and the camera second. I mean, presuming that you don't have any other constraints, like you need a certain type of sensor or certain other constraints.
It's interesting you should say that. I had, oddly enough, I mentioned this earlier, you have led to my downfall because you said that the M10M was one of your favorite cameras, the monochrome M10, or maybe it was an M9 monochrome. So I, of course, had to have one. And so when I got it, I liked it so much that I realized I really wanted to shoot color also. So that led to an M10R.
Yeah, you know, I had that problem too. And I think It's a good problem to have. I'm not complaining, but I you know what? I haven't picked up that M10R in months, and I use the monochrome all the time. I don't even know why I have it. Paul, you shoot colors. So like I would, I mean, I think the M10R might prove to be the last great digital Leica that they.
I think you're right. What was fun was I happened to have an 8-element Summicron that was made for the M3. So it had goggles. And I also had a Light Lens Lab 8-element Summicron, which is the Chinese version of the Leica lens. I tested them. Side by side and tripoded, you know, brick wall and real life scenarios, there was absolutely no difference in them. I mean, I could not see a difference between the two. And that surprised me.
I think that the modern coatings and modern lens making, it's easier to replicate that now. It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I'm sure that there are people who say, you know, oh, it's not quite the same, or anything can look like anything. I mean, I strive personally to have my photographs be correct when they come out of the camera. And so I really like, and I'm not on a high horse about it. I mean, I flub plenty of photographs, don't get me wrong, but I use a lens because I like the flavor of the lens. You know, and I've had people come up to me and go, oh, man, Mr. Big Leica man using that crummy old lens. Well, yeah, this is what I like, you know. So, and again, it's not about right or wrong. It's about what's right for you, you know, or for me. And so and I think that if people appreciated the other lenses like our lenses and vintage lenses more, that they would realize that you can really get some very beautiful photographs. I mean, a 35 millimeter f3.5 lens from the 1940s, tack sharp if you're shooting it out, you know, outside, not in really, you know, harrowing conditions. It's a tack sharp lens, terrific lens.
And the Summars, even the 50 Summar, which is, you know, a cheap ass lens.
That's right.
It's red mount.
That's right.
Even wide open, they have a you know, this is going to sound stupid, but they have that Leica glow.
Yeah.
That you don't see with a Summicron at f2.
Do they have the glow even when the front element isn't scratched to hell?
Did somebody say Summar?
Well, you know, that we won't talk about that. That's a do-it-yourself soft focus kit. Yeah, well, you know, it's easier to use a Summar than it is to smear Vaseline on your front element.
It's sharp in the middle.
Yeah, I've heard people describe that as the Summar in particular as a soft sharp look. So it's got a softness to it, but it's in focus and it just doesn't have that crispness of like a Summar on or something. Well,
it's just amazing that this is 1935. Some guy using a slide rule. It's absolutely amazing what they were able to do.
Just remember, they're all unique too. Everyone is unique.
Oh, they are. I mean, there's no consistency among them. I mean, it's like. You know, you got two guys sitting next to each other making the same lens. You couldn't tell they were even the same lens. But once you stop them down to f5, 6, or 8.
Paul, as our resident Leica SLR pusher, where do you recommend that people start if somebody's interested in checking one out? Is it the SL2 that is the sweet spot? Is it the R4? Where would you guide somebody who wants to dip their toe into the Leica SLR world?
I would go to an SL. For sure. And the reason is that it's, you know, a lot of smart guys say that the Leica SL2 might be the most perfect SLR film camera ever made. And I won't go into, you know, I don't know their justification for that, but it really is a good camera. The only problem with it is, like a lot of things, it has not aged well in certain aspects. And the delamination and the silvering of the prism is something you really got to look at on SLs or SL2s, because the silvering does go away on them. And usually they're usable. You'll just see some brown, tiny brown spots in the finder. And it's annoying, but it doesn't really keep you from using.
I could maybe, since I'm kind of new, really, to the Leica SLRs, Anthony, Paul loaned me the R8, which I sent back. He just sent me this SL2 black. I've previously shot in an original Leica Flex, the original 1966 model, and I have an R4. So by no means have I shot them all, right? But I can already tell you some generalizations. And how I would answer your question, Anthony, about where to get started is, as always, it depends on what you're looking for. In my opinion, if you think of Leica as a rangefinder company, you love the screw mounts, you love the M series, you know, even through the M8 or M7, I mean, the film ones, I'm saying, and you want that metal German, if it takes 6 parts to do something, they're going to use 12, you know, that ethos, that is so prevalent in the M series, you got to do the SLs. The SL is a huge improvement over the original Leica Flex, and the SL2 is a marginal improvement over the SL. And I was flashing this in front of the camera earlier, but this SL2, I've had this thing for 5 hours and I'm already in love with it. I had Paul's R8 for 3 weeks. And I had to force myself to finish the roll. I felt the camera was too chunky. It looks cool. Very cool looking camera. Made excellent images, right? The pictures were outstanding. Viewfinder bright. I could not get over the chunky, thick body. Something Johnny said earlier about muscle memory. Even though I've never, before 5 hours ago, have never held one of these cameras, I don't need to look at it and I can feel the controls. I know where the shutter speed dial is. I know where the wind lever is. I know how to instinctively grip the focusing ring, right? I've never handled this camera before. The ergonomics are already familiar with me. If I were to shoot this SL2, muscle memory would be in effect. When I had that R8, the shutter speed dial or the program auto exposure dials on the left, I found that the grip for the, I had the zoom lens on it. It just did not feel right to me. I felt like I was holding an alien camera. It didn't speak to me. I didn't like it. Now, I think Theo, you have an R8, right?
Yeah, I do. I actually went through a slightly different process. I started off with an R3, which had a problem. And on Paul's recommendation, I got the R4. Now, this R4 had an issue and I had to send it back, but it wasn't with the actual shooting. It was actually, it was a ancillary problem, but I didn't want to sort of pay for a camera, which with an issue. But I loved shooting with it. I then got another R4 and it had exposure issues. So that sort of went back. But again, I loved shooting both of them. And I thought, well, two R4s, add them together, you get an R8. So I went and bought an R8. I'm sure there's logic there that somewhere, but anyway. And I must admit, the R8 is probably my favorite SLR to shoot now. And I'm a Nikon shooter. So it really sort of spoke to me. Now, having said that, I love shooting with the R4. It is a great experience and it is a great camera, especially because it's smaller and it's a little bit more traditional.
Yeah.
But the R8, if I want something top quality, recent, it just sort of, I think they designed it really well because they just break the mold and design something that was totally new.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found that it's easy to use. Its viewfinder is just magic. I mean, that's the one thing that really got me. It's magic. It's got a lot of lights down the bottom and with, you know, the LCD and so on, but it's not invasive in the actual picture that you're trying to take.
Yeah. I mean, everything you said, I agree with. It just didn't speak to me. It felt like an alien camera in my hand, whereas the SL2, again, back to what I said, though, it depends on what you're looking for. If you think of Leica as a rangefinder company, you have an M3 or an M4 or something, you're thinking, hey, I wonder what their SLRs are like. I would say go with the SL or the SL2. I feel like even though they're two very different style cameras, you know, SLR versus rangefinder, I'm not going to get into that. But I feel like that's an easier transition than jumping from like an M3 to an R8 would be. If you don't have the money for the R8 or just don't like the appeal or the size of it, because it is big, the R4 is a great camera. You know, that's based off of the Minolta XD11. There is a bit of a Japanese layout to this. You know, it relies a little bit more on electronics. It's still a very heavy camera. It looks great. I mean, the R4 is a very attractive camera too. Bright, you know, red Leica logo on it. A little bit more modern, you know, but it doesn't feel like a mechanical rangefinder anymore. So if you want to be able to shoot Leica with Leica lenses, Leica quality, go with an R, you know, and then just you can determine whether you want the R3 or the R8, depending on which features are more important to you. If you want something that looks unlike anything else, you got to get the R8. But for a more traditional camera, I'd go with the R4. But if you're a Leica purist and want to make that transition from the rangefinder market to SLRs, my vote would be the SL or the SL2.
Well, in the pile of Leica Flexes I got was one, besides that R4 that Mike has now, I got one R7. Which was the final camera until they went to the guppy body shape on the R8. And I was really impressed with it. It's actually a very nice camera. It handles well. The metering modes on it are interesting.
Yeah.
I wasn't dissatisfied with that camera at all.
Yeah, Paul, I was going to ask you, are there any turkeys or any dead ends that you should avoid if you're looking at these bodies? Because you never really hear about the 5, the 6, and the 7. You know, hear a lot about the fours.
You know what happened when they had the R4? The problem with the R4 was they did have some circuit board problems in them. And they made too many different models. They had an R4, there's an R4S, And then there was an R4SP. And then suddenly there's an R5, there's an R6, there's an R6.2. And, you know, then the R7, they changed models too often. And there were very minor differences between a lot of them. An R4 is a good camera. It's good to stay right around serial number above 1,600,000. That's the improved circuit board.
I'm sending this back.
Yours is 152.
Yeah.
154. So I think you're okay. I think they just say 1.6 because that's easier to say.
I've got a question for you, like a SLR experts. You mentioned Minolta, and I know Minolta made those. Did Minolta ship those off to Leica, and Leica would calibrate them and okay them? Did they have Leica people at the factory in Japan? How did that unfold?
No, they were made in Germany or Portugal.
Oh, they were made in Germany, the R camera. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the R's were made in Portugal or Germany. It depends on which model.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Paul, we had some, wasn't there a model made in Midland as well, in Ontario?
An R?
Yes.
Wow.
I think so.
Yes, there was. There was.
Yeah, I think so.
Was. Yeah, there was one model, and I don't remember what it was, but yeah, they did make one body, maybe an R4SP or one of those models. I think that's correct.
I'll tell you a couple of things to look at. I wanted Paul to answer the question at first because he's got all the inventory. I don't really have anything, but Anthony, I'll tell you what I think about the R cameras. I agree with everything that you guys said. I find the the R8 and R9 kind of ungainly. I think that if you've got a good strong back or you haven't been to the gym lately, you could get a Leica Flex or a Leica Flex SL. I mean, they're heavier cameras, but there's something about that, the metal and that mirror slapping.
Yeah.
I mean, you know you've taken a picture. And what Paul is saying about the viewfinder is very true, but they're very basic and very steady cameras, and they're much easier to repair than any of the later cameras. The R3 is a good camera in particular for pounding nails. The R4 is good, especially above 1,600,000. The R4S and the R4SP make terrific doorstops.
What changed at 1,600,000? Like, what's the difference?
Different circuit boards.
They had circuit board problems.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, circuit boards. It was circuit boards. And then the R5, the R6, and the R7 are all the same form factor, and they're terrific cameras with little kind of variations in the metering. And Paul actually probably knows a little bit more about this than I do. But I'll tell you what the crown jewel of the R system was, is the R6.2, because it's fully mechanical and it has a meter. Now, my recollection is that the R6 and the R7 are also fully mechanical. In other words, if you take the batteries out, the shutter still fires.
The problem with the R6.2 was it was a Seiko shutter. And when Seiko stopped making those shutters, nobody will work on them anymore.
Oh, see, there you go. You learn something new every day.
That's the problem. And I agree. Everybody that has ever owned an R6.2 that works loves it. And it's a mechanic. It's a manual camera.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a manual mechanical camera. But the shutter, you know, the fact that it's going to be really difficult if anything goes wrong has created some issues with that particular one.
Oh, that's interesting. I never knew that. I've always thought them to be the most reliable of all. And in all my years so far, I've only seen a few of them not working, needing repair and going out for parts.
It's like everything. It's like everything, you know, it's today. There are things that are going to fail over time.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, I don't know that they ever repaired any of them under warranty because it probably none of them broke. You know, the Seiko shutters were very reliable.
Right.
The 6.2, isn't that commanding a premium also because Sebastio Salgado is famous for using one of those?
I don't really have my finger on that pulse. I don't, that's possible. It's very possible. I don't know. I mean, sometimes people see, you know, Brad Pitt or Kim Kardashian with a Leica and that, or it's on the cover of Harrington's or whatever. And it, you know, the market goes bonkers.
Yeah.
Dan, the Camerosity podcast is well on its way to being influencers ourselves. So if you find yourself with a surplus of something, just let us know and we'll hype it up for a little bit and help you sell them.
Oh, that would be wonderful. You are influencers. You influence me constantly. Listen, here's what we got. I've got boxes of R3s and I've got Leica flexes, and I've got all this stuff for anybody who wants to start a camera repair business or who might be interested in shooting a camera that has a meter, but the meter doesn't work, you know, stuff like that. We got tons of it. So,
well, you know, Dan, Yellow Springs isn't that far from Chicago.
That's right. I can come up and take a truckload. Well, the thing about the R3 was, you know, and there was a time when you had the joint venture between Minolta and Leica. And it was they were pretty friendly, and so that happened with the CL, the Minolta Leica CL, and a couple lenses that were there. Then you had the R3, which was an XE7, and then you had the R4, which was an XD11. But the other thing they did was they did some lenses. Leica or Minolta actually made two prime lenses for the Leica R mount.
And the R mount, yep, that's correct.
The 16mm and the 500mm. Both of which are Minolta made lenses made in Japan, and several zooms. I think, and I may be wrong about this, but I think Leica actually only made one zoom lens. It was a 28-70mm 3.5 f/4.
What was the zoom on the R8 you loaned?
That was a 35-70 f/4 or 3.5.
Okay.
That was a Minolta made lens. But I have the 16 that I picked up in this last go around, and it looks just like a Rokor. I mean, it has the Minolta, it was the same shape.
Dan, if you're real serious about getting rid of that stuff, maybe we'll have the Camerosity outlet at Tamarkin Camera. We'll have to set that up.
I would love that. You know, yeah, that would be great. Actually, maybe sometime this summer we can do a meetup in Chicago if you guys like. Yeah. We can, every July at Tamarkin Camera, we have Leica-palooza, and there's usually a camera show called Danny T's Bargain Basement that occurs in tandem. And so we should make it a joint venture.
Well, we'll get Anthony. We'll be completely healed by then. He'll be able to travel. We'll get Theo to go on a business trip to Chicago. So we'll get Paul and I already have shirts. Theo and Anthony have shirts too. Maybe by then we'll have some swag. I forgot to say at the Cincinnati show, there were these two ladies that showed up, literally thought we were selling t-shirts. Because I think we had said Paul and I are going to be there with our t-shirts, not realizing like we'd be wearing our t-shirts. But this lady's like, I want to buy a Camerosity t-shirt. And she was so disappointed that we weren't actually selling them.
I didn't know that, Mike. I would have sold mine.
Oh, really? You'd really taken it right off.
Wouldn't be the first time, right?
No, I've undressed at plenty of camera shows.
Good segue. Let's transition back to Johnny. There was an article that appeared today that you wrote about some new spools. You're not making the spools. You just kind of partner with these guys that maybe weren't doing a good enough job at promoting themselves, and you really like the product. So you want to tell us a little more about that?
Yeah. So this company, a small startup in Germany, actually, I've never said their name out loud. I'm sure I'd butcher it. But go to Petapixel's website today, and my article's there, quick load spools for like a Barnex prior to the 3G this spool fits in. And it's a product that I was actually looking for. I was trying to figure out a way, because like back to what we were talking about earlier about shooting weddings with Barnex, or you know, my professional gigs with Barnex, I'd like to do more of that. One of the things that holds me back is just having to reload. I'm not one of these people that complains about loading Barnex. I get why, you know, there's some extra steps to it, given that the camera was built in the 19 or designed in the 1930s, 1920s. One thing that holds me back is just loading. So I've been looking for a solution to faster loading, because I'm like, why can we do it in the M cameras, but we couldn't do it in the Barnex cameras? So someone came up with this. These guys are selling 3D printed take-up spools. You drop your film in like an M, basically it turns the Barnex into an M without a film door. So you drop your film in, and you don't have to trim your leader, and you don't have to take out the spool. You just drop your film in like an M. It takes some getting used to do that without the door. I think if you know you're used to using the door, some people don't use the door, so they're probably right at home. It's a little bit of a contentious topic, because Leica, Barnex Leica shooters love to, you know, tell people that you have to trim the leader, you have to trim the leader. But this is, as you can see from the reel that Mike's holding up, it has the tulip, three tulip design that the M4 has.
I'll try to explain it, because it's difficult, but it does look like a tulip. So you have like a center shaft, and it has the bumps on it for the sprockets. And then there's three like outer pieces that kind of flare outward, and they have the bumps on them. So you have the the sprocket holes on both the inside and the outside. And I mean, I obviously don't have a camera here, but I explained the first time you sent me one of these, I played with it outside the camera just so I could get a feel for what I'm doing, which I think anybody would have to do to kind of get how this thing works. But you slide it in the camera through the bottom and you push it in all the way. And they're designed to just be left there. Like, you could keep taking it back out, but they fit quite tightly. I think, Johnny, you said you had to use tweezers to pull yours out.
Yeah.
But I would say if you have multiple cameras you want to use these in, you would just get multiple spools and just leave them in there. And I'm going to show you guys this, but essentially, if you could pretend this thing is in the camera, you just drop the film on the inside. And it's not going to do it here because I'm doing it like that. Okay, so I just slid it behind one of the tulips like this. And then as you twist it, it starts to wrap itself around. And the tulips are what hold the leader. So, I mean, if you can imagine this being inside the camera, I mean, I'm pulling on this pretty hard. I mean, I don't want to rip it, but it's not coming undone. And I think the flaw with using the traditional spool is you're sticking this tiny little leader into the little slot, and it's very easy for it to come out. This thing kind of like keeps it in place. And because you have the little bumps for the sprocket holes on both the inner part of the spool and then the outer tulips, that as it's wrapping around itself, it's gripping it really well. And when you rewind it, so let's say I'm rewinding it now, I'm spinning it the other way, you just pull, it just pulls right out. Do you see how easy that came out?
This thing is genius. And not only do I want one for myself, but I want to sell them. It's absolutely genius. I read Johnny, I read your article.
Oh,
and as soon as I was like, I gotta have some of those. So I'm gonna connect with you about that very soon. I'm envious that Mike's got one. I can't wait to get my hands on one.
I've been shooting with them for quite a while. Actually, I found these guys in like late November of last year, and just through some, you know, random eBay scrolling and being up late and delirious. And I stumbled across their reel. I wrote to him. I talked to him a little bit about it. I bought one from them and told him I was interested in, you know, reviewing it. And these guys are just a little startup. So they 3D print all kinds of cool little gizmos for vintage cameras. They're two guys based out of Germany. They both went to school for engineering. One guy, he was a bicycle mechanic. So if that tells you anything, like, you know, these guys are into like simple, elegant solution sort of based tools.
Somebody commented on your post, they make replacement prongs for Nikkor AI lenses.
Yeah.
They have a bunch of like weird little things you didn't think you might need, but could come in handy.
Maybe Mike, you can drop a link when this is posted.
Yeah, I will.
But they have all kinds of cool stuff. But anyway, I tested roll after. I didn't want to, you know, this is a really exciting product to me because, like I said, I could start using my Barnex more in a professional capacity than, you know, I bring them with me sometimes and I just take a couple, like, you know, I'll take like a roll or two, but they're not sort of the centerpiece of what I'm doing most of the time. But I think this is going to help me move them more into the forefront with my M6s, because the idea is, you know, I can treat them more like rapid loading, like my M6s. A lot of people say they don't, you know, shoot these kind of cameras to shoot fast, but I think that you can find an appeal in them also, just because, you know, for me, like shooting film, right? Like the things you want to slow down about are, you know, being deliberate about like your exposure and your focus and your composition and things like that. I don't think loading, just getting the film into the camera is like something that that needs to be any like more difficult. You know, I mean, it's cool and all, it's meditative. Yeah.
I mean, it's fun. Yeah. But I don't need the film loading experience to be more difficult. And while I've never subscribed to the, I hate bottom loaders that some people do, I think many people blow it way out of proportion. It's not as hard as it, some people say it is, but it is still more difficult. There is extra work involved.
It's just extra steps. Right. And that's what, and for me, you know, this product eliminates that. And so I shot a number of rolls. I think I mentioned it on the Petapixel article. I don't have the numbers in my mind anymore, but I did, you know, Mike tested some in his cameras and I tested them for months. I actually broke the first version that they gave me and they revised it. They thickened up the plastic and shored it up a bit more. And so I've shot more rolls in the new one than I have the old one now. I haven't had any breakages, haven't had any issues.
I'm squeezing this with a good amount of pressure and it is not flexing at all. I mean, you'd really have to do something crazy, to break this. But the one thing, and Johnny mentioned this in the article, but I will agree, this thing is very clearly 3D printed. It looks like a cheap piece of plastic, but it just works really, really well. So if you run into somebody who wouldn't dare put this 3D printed rough edged piece of plastic in their pristine Leicas, I could see some people not wanting to do that. But
it's definitely a photographer's tool. It's not a collector's. But one of the things I said in the article is, you know, if you find yourself taking your vacation snapshots, whatever, on your cell phone instead of the Barnack Leica you're carrying with you, this is the kind of product I think that's going to help you. Why am I using my cell phone when I have this beautiful vintage camera here? Oh, maybe it's because it's less convenient. This is going to help you make it more convenient to use the camera that you prefer, I think.
Well, and I like anything in life that solves a problem, even if it's a minor one, in an easy way. This thing's not complicated. The first time I used it, it worked perfectly. I did not have to fumble with it. It didn't break. And I appreciate things in life, true life hacks, things that are simple, easy, and cheap. And this pretty much checks off all three of those boxes.
Dan, do you remember Luigi Crescenzi's stuff that he used to make for M6s?
Oh, yeah. He made all kinds of different stuff for M6s.
Well, he made the wonderful Leica Time cases, leather, handmade leather half cases for M6s.
Oh, yeah. They're beautiful.
He also had, he had two products that were just fantastic. One of them was called a slide, which was a piece of neutral density, sticky neutral density material that went over one of the rangefinder windows on the M6 to change the contrast. And so it let you focus much easier in low light.
Yeah,
because it was giving a contrast between the two windows. The other thing he made was called a scoop, which was just like a half a donut that fit over the viewfinder window, and it kept you from scratching your glasses. I mean, it was just a fantastic. I mean, it were dirt cheap, but it was one of those things that, you know, it just made it more enjoyable to use the camera because they were functional.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Just like this take-up spool.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a couple of scoops that I use all the time, actually.
I bought a half dozen of them.
I have one on my M2 and one on my M6TTL.
Yeah, I keep them. I keep them too.
Robert, you've been busy lately. How are things going with you?
Yeah, it's going fine. I'm keeping busy all the time. I got to get over to your place pretty soon.
Yeah, you got to come back and
Yeah, I know. I've got that one wood camera I have to return to you.
Yeah, it's not a wood camera. I loaned it to Robert. Somebody took a Sony Alpha digital mirrorless camera and built a wooden shell. So they literally just slipped the camera inside of this wooden shell, but the wooden is hand engraved to look almost exactly like a Nikon SP.
Yeah.
And so it has the original Sony E-mount, but somebody put an S-mount adapter on it. So it actually accepts Nikon rangefinder lenses, but it's 100% a digital camera. There's a little window in the back for the rear LCD, and they lined up all the buttons on the wooden case that actually push the Sony buttons underneath. It's far out. Like, I don't know who made something like that, but it's weird.
I don't know if it was commercially made or not, but
no, I'm sure it was. There's no way. I mean, it's handmade completely. I've never seen one before.
I've seen one online with a Nikon S.
This one looks like an SP.
I've seen an S that was done. It was in Japan. It was all in Japanese, so I couldn't translate it.
Maybe whoever made it just did one of each.
Possible.
So, all right. Well, Brock, you're there. Yeah, I know you said you love cameras and wanted to just join us, but what do you like to shoot?
I'm a pretty big Argus fan.
All right.
Yeah, I'm rocking my Michigan farm boy Leica.
So Argus from Ann Arbor, you like shooting Argus cameras up there, right?
I sure do.
So at the Cincinnati show, Rick Olison showed up, and he was there not even 2 minutes. And he reaches down, he goes, look what I just bought. And he hands me an Argus A4, I think it was an A4R, but it had the Anawork 50mm f1.9 lens on it, which for Argus collectors, it's a really rare lens, very uncommon. And the guy had it sitting on a table. I think he paid like $30 for it. I was like, damn it.
The guy was right next to me.
Yeah, we didn't see it.
And I don't know why I didn't see it.
Because you sold one of those for what, $300 a couple years back?
Yeah. Just the lens.
Just the lens. Now, the one thing I'll say is it was jammed on the body. It was completely seized. So of anybody to pick up that camera, Rick Olison was the perfect person to get it because he's texting me that night. He's like, all right, I took this thing apart and I'm trying to clean it. get it, you know, unstuck. And he finally says to me, he's like, okay, I got it working again. I was like, cool. So I'm glad it went to someone who's gonna appreciate it. But yeah, that's cool. You're from Michigan. I've gone up there many, many times and shot a lot of my American cameras. I usually like to bring, you know, something up there, a C3, one of the C4s. I shot my Argoflex up in Michigan and the UP at Mackinac Island a couple times. It just feels like a kind of a homecoming for those cameras.
Have you brought it to the museum?
No, I've never been to Ann Arbor. I've never been to the Argus Museum. Oh, no. I want to go. But our when we go, because I go up to Northern Michigan often, but we're always coming up from like around Chicago. So we're going up through like Holland to Grand Rapids and straight north. I never get to the east side of the state.
Gotcha.
I want to, though. We were going to talk about a bunch of April Fool stuff. We're going to have go on about Kickstarter cameras that didn't ever pan out. But I kind of felt like this episode sort of transitioned into a like episode, which is fine.
So our April Fool's joke is not to talk about April Fool's.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, we did our dumb intro there. But one camera, I wanted to come prepared because I felt like I had the perfect camera to talk about, a Kickstarter that people were really excited about. And when it finally came out, people were just, I can't believe how much of a piece of crap this thing is. It was this Yashica, they called it the Y35 Digifilm camera. It looks sort of like a Yashica Electro. It's in an all plastic body. And the crazy thing about this one, they call it Digifilm. So you open up the back, the film compartment. And in there are these little, we can see the batteries. There's two AA batteries. But it uses these ridiculous little, they look like APS Advantix film cassettes. And all it is it has these little pins. And when you plug them in, it pushes down the pins in a certain way that essentially changes the mode of the camera. So I think they made a total of 6 of these cassettes. I have 4 of them. The one that's in there now puts it in black and white mode. There's one that emulates 200 speed color. I have one that emulates 1600 speed color. And I have another one that forces it to shoot square images, like a TLR or something. And I think they made 2 other like art ones, which I don't have. And this camera is, it's like 150 grams. Putting the batteries in almost doubles the weight of the camera. It's got like a Japanese optical, you know, fake lens. The serial number on every one of these is exactly the same. Like they just mass produce the bodies, the same thing. It does have a film advance lever. So you do wind it to cock the shutter and you press the shutter release to fire it. So you can't press this unless you wind it. It's got what looks to be an accessory shoe that's actually too small. So it's not even a hot shoe. If you tried to mount a modern flash to it, it's not even the right size. Apparently, they were going to make an LED light accessory, but it wasn't even a flash. It was literally just a light that stayed on all the time that would help raise the light so the sensor could go. The viewfinder is just straight through plastic. I mean, there's no frame lines at all. It's just cheap plastic. This thing is the biggest piece of crap in the world. But then I shot it and I was like, wait a minute, like, let me set the bar very low here. Okay. They're not great. Okay. But they don't look nearly as bad as I thought they would. I shared a couple of them in our private chat to Anthony and Paul and Theo. And I don't know, like, to me, they're like, it's like a cell phone. Like, it's almost like they took a self, and that's probably what they did. Honest. How else would you make a camera this shitty? Is to just take like an old, you know, 2014 surplus cell phone module, put it inside a hollow plastic body with just barely enough electronics to add a trigger and an external shutter release, and house it in a optical plastic fake lens. But it does work. And
when was it made? You know when it was made?
I'm sure it was made in China on Mondays.
I didn't know Yashica still used the name Yashica on their cameras. They still use Yashica?
Oh, it's not Yashica. It's some export company bought the rights to the name and put it on there. Like there's that new mirrorless they're talking about that's got the Yashica name that's still coming out. So this thing was hyped to be the return of Yashica. It looks, if I just held it way back here and said, hey, look, I got a new digital Yashica Electro, and then took it away, you'd probably like, oh, show me more. I want to learn more about it.
But the problem is it's eating into the M6 sales that Dan's trying to...
That's right. That's right. They're muscling in on my market.
So you're the reason I spent so much time on that is I was totally ready. I was fully prepared to trash on this thing of just how ridiculous the having to change the little cassettes in the back. It's, I mean, I don't want to break it, but I mean, this plastic door, I mean, it wiggles.
I don't want to break it.
Like, I mean, I could break it by blowing on it too hard. It is that cheaply made.
I have two questions about this camera.
Sure. Go ahead.
The first one is, couldn't they just have put switches on the outside instead of making you put different cassettes on the inside?
Absolutely. Right. But that's the experience, though.
The second one is, where did you find a bubble gum machine that's still working to buy that out of?
It came. I have the original box.
It must have been a huge bubble gum machine.
It was actually a big Kickstarter, Dan.
It was. It's cute. It is cute. I have a third question. How much is it? Is it expensive?
I don't think it's for sale anymore, but I think the Kickstarter was like $150.
Okay.
And people were mad at that. And I would be too. I would not. Well, let me rephrase. If somebody told me there was a Kickstarter to get a new Yashica film digital camera and it only costs $150, I'd be like, no way. You know, I mean, what's that new Rolly 35 that's being made? They're estimating it's going to have a price.
Well, 35 AF.
Yeah. I think they're estimating the price to be somewhere around $600 to $700. Like, that sounds reasonable to mass produce.
And that looks like it's going to be a premium camera. It really does.
A premium. But I mean, the point is, though, to make anything new from the ground up, I mean, no matter how popular film is, none of these cameras are going to sell anywhere near the numbers that they would have way back then. So no matter how successful any of these Kickstarters are, they're still going to be niche products. And make a niche product, to scale it, you need to raise the price to be able to physically just be able to make it. So for no matter how cheap this thing is, I don't know that it can be made for much cheaper than $150. So in my opinion, I didn't fund this, okay, at all. This just fell into my lap. But I don't necessarily think that for $150, you should have really expected much more than what you got. But people were pissed about this. You can go on Google and just search for these. And there's a whole bunch of just horrible reviews about them, how cheap they are. And they're right. It's cheap. But I think that in my experience, and I've read a few other people who actually take the time to shoot it, it's like, it's really not that bad. Like, the images aren't that bad. You know, if you want this is a Lomo camera, not made by Lomo. So that, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. So it's the April Fool's prank is that the April Fool's camera is better than I thought it would.
Isn't the Yashica name trying to correct that? The people that have the Yashica name trying to correct that? Because aren't they bringing out some sort of Micro Four Thirds camera with some tiny sensor?
It's a mirrorless. They're making a new mirrorless. And I haven't learned, I don't know much about it. I've only seen a few pictures of it.
I actually think there's a article in Petapixel about that today too. They collaborated with that company I'm Back that made the drop in, like, right, the film fate.
Yes, that's it.
Not film, but digital cassettes that look like, you know, for old film cameras. Yeah, I mean, that seems like a more serious product. I just wanted to jump in, and there's actually two points about this product that I think that is interesting. One thing is that I think, you know, there's so many sort of products like this where people are trying to tap into the excitement in the film market, and they're trying to make, you know, digital products or modern products of some sort that tap into that, and I think that's, you know, however weird the iterations of the, you know, end results are, I think that's kind of cool. I also think, you know, the film community, we got to give people, you know, there was a lot of backlash against this camera, and I'm a big fan of the two Kodak Ektar H35 half-frame cameras that have been released, the 35N, and they're made by a Chinese company called Rito. I'm actually a big fan of those. I bought the first one, and then they sent me the second one to do a review on, because they did one on the first one. I really like these, and people complain about, you know, these plastic cameras and cheap cameras, and I think that we don't often appreciate how undervalued our classic cameras are. You know, we don't pay that much for a lot of them, you know, and so I think we have, like, sort of an unrealistic expectation of how much money it actually costs to produce these novel designs, and especially when it comes to mechanical and film cameras.
Take apart a Rolleiflex and just admire all of that action is being done on these tiny little gears and springs that some technician installed by hand. I mean, you're 100% right, Johnny. People don't appreciate how much technology has gone into this. We had Bob Shanebrook on a number of episodes ago, and he made a comment that somebody said that the amount of technology and effort that went into making Kodak film is one of the most impressive technological milestones of like mankind. Okay. He was embellishing maybe a little, being from Kodak himself. You know, we went to the moon for Christ's sake, but the amount of effort that goes into making just film is amazing. You know, Kodachrome took 17 steps to develop. There's so much technology, and that a folding camera from the turn of the last century with a Zeiss Tessar lens and a Comper shutter, when cleaned, can still make images that, when scanned in a computer, rival that of digital cameras today. It's just mind-blowing. And without a doubt, my favorite part of this hobby.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of my things too. Back to, you know, we were talking about Argus earlier. One of the first cameras I learned to try to repair on my own before I decided I want to be a photographer, not a repair technician, was the Argus C3. Just the, you know, the sort of elegant simplicity of those cameras, because it's, you know, sort of like Leica, but a lot more basic and clunky, I think. Maybe not as elegant. But yeah, you just, I hate to say they don't make them like they used to, but they really don't. And in the cases of companies trying to make them like they used to, like the Rolly 35AF, you know, I've been following Mint for a long time, you know, who's making the Rolly 35AF. They've partnered with the license holders of Rolly for that camera, and the TL70 that they produced also. They're doing some really cool stuff. I have the TL70, you know, twin lens Instax camera, and they're doing really unique work that I think, you know, their cameras are, you know, on the upper price range, but there's just not a lot of options, not a lot of mavericks out there doing this mechanical stuff anymore. And I think it's cool. I think we should definitely support that, even if they've got some plastic components that we're not happy with.
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I also sort of refer back to the whole Pentax thing, where everyone's now grumbling, oh, they're being out of half frame, but, you know, boo-hoo and so on. But if you look at it, what they're trying to do is they're trying to tiptoe into the market and do it right and build something, you know, like the quality. If they come out with a $400 camera and it's effectively a H35 Kodak, then I'd say, okay, well, we got all that wrong. But from what I can see is they're actually trying to build a quality camera. And what they've sort of realized is they can't go from go to, you know, bringing out the equivalent of, you know, a top SLR in one go. So they're sort of, you know, looking at, you know, half frame. They'll probably look at a compact and then move into an SLR field. So it's to what your point, Johnny, it's, you know, that quality takes time, takes workmanship, takes people that know what they're doing, and comes at a cost.
And it takes us, frankly, because we're the people that are gonna, you know, buy it or not buy it, right? So
yeah, exactly.
That's right.
And if it's not for you, don't buy it. It's not the end of the world. Yeah, it doesn't mean it's a bad product.
The Kodak Super 8 is another sort of in this category that I think a lot of people get really angry when they see how expensive it is, and, you know, they're like, you know, well, you could just mimic Super 8 on digital cameras, you know, why this doesn't make any sense, you know. But I think you're right. It's about tiptoeing into that market. It's these companies are trying to give us what we're asking for, and we keep pushing back on them and saying, no, that's not exactly what I want. I want exactly this. And
anytime I've ever heard anybody online or in real life that says, well, why, what's the point of shooting film? Couldn't you just mimic it digitally? At that point, you can't engage any more conversation with someone like that. My one response is, you know what? You're right. That's it. I mean, it is. If they believe that.
And you know what? They are. It is what's good for them.
Right.
They are right. Yeah. So it's perfect for them.
That's not the point, though, of why we do this. And someone exactly. who gives you that argument, it's just not worth, you know, it's like, you know what? You're right. Thanks. Bye. So we're near the end here. Does anybody have any questions or anything we haven't covered?
Oh, just to, if you're going to dismantle a Rolleiflex to admire it, do you have to put it back together again? And does it have to work? Does it have to work after you get it back together?
That's true. You could go on YouTube and watch one of those videos of somebody repairing it. Or okay, better yet, like Chris Sherlock's retina repair videos that he does. That's if you want to see a complicated camera with the inner workings, watch him taking apart a retina reflex 4 or something like that. So this is episode 68. So 2 weeks from today, we will record episode 69. We keep mulling in our private chat, Paul, Anthony, and Theo, about what we're going to do, but we never decide what we're going to do. So let's make a decision, gents. What are we going to do? Are we going to do ZeissIcon, or are we going to cover something else? What should we entice our listeners with to look forward to the next episode?
You know, we did talk about doing cameras of decades.
Decades, that's right, we did.
Yeah, so maybe do a 70s or an 80s, do a 70s, 80s, 90s. Not in the same episode, maybe, but cameras of the 70s to start with.
All right, we will do that then. We will start, instead of brand-specific episodes, maybe talk about an era, you know, and what were the highlights. We could talk about the R3 again.
I mean, we got a lot, there are a lot of Mamiyas in there, Yashicas, you know, yeah. The people's camera, you know, the cameras that you could buy in department stores.
Well, and I like cameras from the 70s because you were seeing a lot more electronics. You're seeing a lot more modernization, more advanced cameras. The smaller SLRs were getting more popular, but it was still, you know, autofocus hadn't really caught on yet. You know, the 80s was kind of a reboot for cameras for a lot of companies. You know, Minolta switched mounts, Canon switched mounts, Nikon, although they kept the F mount, they changed their product lineup to me. Even, you know, I think, you know, just to very quickly touch back on the Leica R models, we were kind of humming and hawing over the R5, 6, and 7. And those came out kind of in that era when there was a lot of, you know, movement forward of the industry. And I think even companies like Lights had to figure out like what they wanted to do with their lineups too, you know, just to simply make a basic SLR with no automation wasn't cutting it anymore for a lot of people. So I think any decade, honestly, I could sit here all day long and do an episode about the 40s.
I miss my 110. I want to bring back 110.
Oh, God, Dan.
I have a crap load of it in the fridge still.
So do you really?
I do. Yeah, it's been refrigerated. Supposedly it works.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the Pentax had a co-op at 4 or 5 lenses.
The 110.
Well, Lomography just released another 110 camera, didn't they?
Did they really? Clearly, I've opened Pandora's box here.
I bought a 110A with the zoom at that show in Cleveland.
I've got an Instamatic 60, a pocket Instamatic 60, and a 50 for that matter.
I bought a Leica 3A from Ray. I looked it up. It's a 1938 serial number. I was attracted to it. It didn't, the shutter was dead on it, but it had beautiful brassing. It had just that right amount of wear that I just loved the way it looked.
I say the shutter was dead. It was tired.
It was tired. It you could tell it had been previously repaired before. So I sent it out to Alan to have them replace the whole thing. So it's going to come back with a new curtains, timed. The rangefinder I thought was accurate, but maybe he could, you know, clean up the glass or something a little bit more. But I'm looking forward to giving that a go.
Yeah, Mike, by the way, we're not supposed to mention the fact that if anyone needs a camera, a mechanical camera repaired, we're not supposed to say that Alan Wade at Camera Works in Waterford, New York does great work, because we don't want to tell people about him because then he take longer to fix our cameras.
We don't want to promote Alan Wade, WADE, at Camera Works.
Does he work on CLs? I recently got a Leica CL that needs something.
He'll do mechanicals, but I don't know if he could repair a meter.
We can take care of the CL.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not too worried about the meter. Oh, can you?
Yeah, we can take care of that. Awesome. I'm going to look up this Wade guy because I got some cameras that need repair.
He does great work. He's an old-fashioned repairman. I mean, he's no website. He has email.
He'll send it back to you before you even pay. He'll like fix your camera, send you a bill. Like,
yeah, he'll send it back. He sends you a bill. Just send him a check.
Boy, I got some work for him.
All right, guys. Thanks for coming on, Dan. As always, awesome to have you on. Johnny, thank you for finally coming on the show. I hope you had you enjoyed the experience.
Absolutely.
Brock, it was a pleasure to meet you. You know, our Desert Island episode we did many, many ago, I brought up the Argus C3 as one of the cameras I love. Such a simple, but ugly, in a beautiful way, camera that shoots really nice pictures. Patrick, Casey, Ray, Mark, it's always good to have you on. Bob, it's awesome to see you again. As always, the topics and discussions on the Camerosity podcast are influenced by you. So we will start an episode talking about one thing and you never know where it's going to go. So join us on a future episode in 2 weeks from today, which this show hasn't even aired yet, but 2 weeks from today is April 15th. We'll be recording a show about cameras from the 70s. Have a great night, everybody, and see you next time.
Good night.
Thanks, y'all. Take care.
Okay. Guys. All right, thanks.
Good night.
Good night, everyone. Mike,
yeah.
Could you have been recording this? I thought you were recording.
Ah! April Fools.
April Fools.
Oh, heart attack.
April Fools.
April Fools. All right.